Now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Those of you listening who are Swiss or know this country very well will be aware that the Swiss often refer to their country as l'exception in French, der Sonderfall in German, the exception in English. Now, that's quite a self-description, but having lived here for almost 40 years, I can tell you from personal experience that there is quite a bit of truth in it. One prominent feature which makes this country stand out from many others is its neutrality. And as it's become richer over the past 100 years or so, its use, usually to good effect, of soft power. Now, these are themes which will come up a lot in today's interview with my very special guest. He is Ambassador Christian Ducey, the outgoing director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy, known as GCSP, which is located in the Maison de la Paix near the United Nations. We will learn more about him as we talk, but briefly, Ambassador Ducey has a security and intelligence background as a Swiss career diplomat. And prior to GCSP, he served as Swiss ambassador and head of the Crisis Management Center of the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs, and that's the coordination of the government's response to major incidents affecting Swiss citizens abroad, like disasters, terror attacks, and hostage taking. He has served at the Swiss Embassy in Moscow and as a diplomatic advisor to the President of the Swiss Confederation. Academically, his background is blue chip, a fellow at Harvard, and educated at Tufts, Fribourg, and Georgetown universities. Recently, it was announced that he will be the next Swiss ambassador to the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's quite a challenge, and he's to be congratulated. It's a great tribute to his qualities. Ambassador Ducey Christian, if I may, welcome to the McKay Interview. It's good to see you again, even though it's only on Zoom.
It's good to see you too, Michael, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
It's my great pleasure. I have a variety of questions to put to you, and because of your very special experience, I cannot think of a better person to answer them, Christian. My first question concerns something which I've often wondered about over the many years that I've lived here. Why are the Swiss so reluctant to step forward to raise their head above the parapet in international affairs and show the world how different languages, different religions, and different cultures can live successfully, prosperously, and in peace together, as the Swiss have done since 1848. You have so much to offer, and there is such a great need for the quality and skills that the Swiss have. Now, before you answer, Christian, is there a clue, perhaps, in the line your diplomatic colleague in London, Ambassador Alexander Fasel, taught me on this show last year? He told me that the Swiss were not evangelists. And he also taught me in French, pour vivre heureux, vivons cachés. To live happy, live hidden. Words from the 18th century French poet, philosopher Florian, as I'm sure you know. But such a philosophy seems a pity to me, but perhaps I'm wrong in my impression of the Swiss. If so, please correct me, Christian.
Yes, Michael. Let me first go back to what my colleague Alexandre Fasel meant.
Yeah.
Not evangelist, yes. But we have, like any other nation's interest, values to defend. And I can assure you that every Swiss diplomat around the world is doing his or her utmost to promote and defend our values and interests and use our strong soft power to achieve our foreign policy objectives. There is no shyness here. It's a duty. And public diplomacy has become very important. This is why we have, for instance, Presence Switzerland, a dedicated division at the foreign ministry in Bern.
Tell me what I've heard about it, but I honestly don't know much about it. What is that?
Yeah, it's the function is just to make sure that the values, the good deeds that Switzerland is doing, and in the education field, in the field of science, in the field of diplomacy, it's well understood with different means, different platform. This is what Presence Switzerland is doing, and if I may. Every Swiss diplomat will also promote Swiss values and soft power based on the personal experiences and in his or her own way. Personally, I'm the product of the power of education and Swiss opportunities. And I often share a story with our course participants. I was born and raised in the Canton Valais. I was the first in my family to attend high school or college. And the valet of my parents and grandparents was not the Valais of today. The Alps have always been a very harsh environment, and similar to other mountainous regions, such as the Caucasus or, for example, the Fatah region on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. In the Alps, you have, as you know, limited opportunities. Agriculture, mercenarism, and services related to transit of people and goods through the Alps were probably the main source of income for many centuries. Tourism and dam buildings came much later. And if you want to get more, just read the Swiss author Charles Ferdinand Ramu to get a better idea.
Tell me the name again.
Okay. He wrote famous books, for example, and the living conditions in the 19th century, La Séparation des Races, or the great fear in the mountain, La Grande Peur dans la Montagne. And overall, investing in education was a key factor of change and progress. And I'm an example of it. And just for the anecdote, I practiced my truck driver's license here in Geneva when I was 20 with my father. And this was the very first time and direct encounter with the UN compound. There was at the time a big transformation underway in one of the buildings. And we were transporting concrete inside the compound.
Really?
So 30 years later, I passed again through the same door, but this time as GCSB director and ambassador. And so I'm the product of the power of education, political stability, and economic development. I can tell you that my story resonates with the course participants from harsh environments.
Well, that's a good story.
It's possible here, so why not elsewhere? And so this is an example of soft power.
That's a good story, Christian. We're going to come back later in our conversation to concrete examples of soft power. But let's go back into your experience, your immediate experience, the last few years. I'm very curious to hear from you about the opportunities and challenges that you've had to face over the past 8 years leading an organization in a crowded peace and security market, to use that expression, and in international Geneva too. At GCSP, you have some rare mixings and encounters of visitors from countries that would not normally or easily bump into or engage with each other. I've seen it personally myself when I've been on the premises. Would it be true to say that it could only happen in neutral Switzerland and in international Geneva, rather than what we might call the normal world? Please tell me a little bit about this aspect of GCSP and its purpose.
Yes, Michael. The GCSP is a center for executive education, a platform for dialogue, and also an incubator for innovative projects in the field of peace and security. And it is supported by a board of 53 member states, including, this is quite unique, the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council.
I see.
And when I explain GCSP to executives from the private sector, who might not know us very well, and might not be familiar with International Geneva, I said that GCSP is, in a sense, the IMD for geopolitics and security.
That's a good example.
We are an international foundation funded by the Swiss government, and we have a very solid brand abroad, ministers, ambassadors, general, private sector executives, heads of NGOs, and they are part of our 9,000 strong alumni community.
Let me interrupt 1 second there, just for the benefit of listeners who might not be familiar with IMD. That's an executive education institution based in the Lausanne area.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, Christian.
Yeah, and I think to understand where we are today at GCSP and what we do, it's also interesting to and useful to understand why we exist. And so there are three key moments that have defined the evolution of the centers. And what is interesting is that they represent three distinctive contributions of Switzerland in the matter of good offices for the strengthening of peace and security in the world. So I go back to history, and the first defining moment is the fact that we as a center are the byproduct of the famous Geneva Summit of November 1985, the first meeting between U.S. President Ronald Reagan and Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. And the meeting and the aftermath was really, at the time, a high point of Swiss good offices. But it also showcased the necessity to build up quickly our national expertise in a specific field for disarmament, arms control, international security. And at the time, they were very much lacking. So the Swiss Department of Defense took the initiative to create a 9-month course that became very famous And by 1989, at the fall of the Berlin Wall, the court was open to European NATO countries, but also former Warsaw Pact countries. And at the time, Soviet Army colonels were sitting next to major of the US Air Force. And that was quite unique. And the court still exists today. Then it's interesting to remember that the second turning point in the history of Switzerland was the important decision of the Swiss people in June 1994 through a referendum to refuse a federal law, a new law, on Swiss peacekeeping under the UN. And at the time, we remember there was a lot of wars and conflict in the Balkans.
Yes, I remember. I was living here.
And this led the Swiss Federal Council to integrate this course that was very famous at the time into a new international foundation, the GCSP, that was created in 1995. And the third element that really a defining moment in what we do, especially now at GCSP, was in 2014 when we entered the new state-of-the-art Maison de la Paix, the brand new transparent building in the middle of international Geneva. And since then, we have more than tripled our activities, number of courses, from 30 to more than 100 per year for 1,200 participants. And I remember we were talking the last time, and I was telling you the unicity of a new program that we have developed called the Global Fellowship Initiative, is that, and I let you imagine, you have a general, a molecular biologist, an ambassador, a banker, a nuclear physicist, an FBI executive, an artificial intelligence expert, an artist, a humanitarian worker, a politician, and a journalist. And they are all in the same room.
It's very powerful. It's very powerful.
Yeah, because they generate extraordinary cross-pollination, yeah. Ideas collide, and there is probably no better way to break silos, foster imagination, and come up with innovative solutions. And we were surprised by the success of the program, and invite your listeners just to check on their website, because it's especially for people in transition in their career.
Yeah. Christian, how would you summarize the challenges facing organizations, private and public, as they navigate and have to fulfill their missions and activities in this fast-moving and unpredictable and turbulent world? I mean, I'm particularly interested in what are the consequences that you see for them and their leaders? And this is the essence of my question. Are there particular skills which leaders today need that were not so important maybe a generation or two ago? Or is it more or less the same set of skills, in your opinion?
Yeah, thank you very much for the question, Michael. The point I will mention and the implication for the organization are the same that I presented, let's say, 2 years ago. Nothing has changed, even though we've been facing a severe COVID pandemic. So when we have to deal with these challenges, and they are the following, we need a new attitude, skills, and tools. But foremost, we have first to understand what are the key facets of our current world, and I will just mention six of them. There is first a convergence of three features: the complexity of the system and issues, their strong interdependence, and the speed of evolution and reaction. The second, we observe every day the rise and breadth of geopolitical and security challenges. Third, and we are in the middle of it now with the COVID pandemic, we have the strong vulnerabilities of our society. We depend on critical infrastructures, complex supply chains, and we are very vulnerable to massive shocks as individual organizations. And there are something that is always there, sometimes we tend to forget, is that it's very difficult to predict brutal changes and moments of rupture.
We've seen that recently.
Yes, and this is common throughout history.
Yeah.
And what we see with the acceleration of technological development, strategic surprises will be probably more frequent than before. Mm. And then my two last points is the impact of exponential technologies, the advances in artificial intelligence, synthetic biology, neuroscience, or quantum computing. They will transform profoundly the way we live and interact. And finally, something that is maybe new for our current world is that the impact of emotions on decision making.
Sure. Which has always been there.
Yes, but now with the spread of social media platform, the development of alternative realities, really a bigger important drivers, and perceptions shape the reality in more profound way than ever before. And all of this has implications for how we run or how we lead organization. The first point is that we need to better understand neighbors, adversaries, and new actors. And I say often that to be now a successful diplomat or a successful CEO, you need to have three pillars. The first, you need the business acumen or diplomatic tradecraft. The second, technological savviness. And third, a profound understanding of your complex environment.
Yeah.
The second is that to face these challenges, you need to increase your ability to anticipate and adapt. And now I've seen that during the past year, for example, in our organization, we have to perform. That means we have to deliver our activities, our services. But at the same time, we have to transform our organization and at all the time. So the ability to anticipate and adapt is becoming even more prevalent than it was before.
So you have lots and lots of moving parts, literally all at the same time.
Yes, yeah. And this is an impact on resilience, is the impact on how creative and resourceful we are. And this is one of the experiences that I take back from my time as the head of the Swiss Foreign Ministry of Crisis Management Center, is that it was already difficult to master and to combine all the different agencies and ministries and so forth during a crisis. But the most difficult task I had at the time was how do you spark creativity in a crisis or leadership team? Mm. Because it's not like out of a second or thinking of out of the box motto, is that creativity has to be nurtured beforehand.
Well, it's how like do you, well, as you've raised the subject, because that was my next question to you, how do you do that then, Christian? I'm interested to know, because my sense is, as an ordinary guy watching television, we see crises, hostage taking on the television news, but of course that's only the tip of the iceberg. What's going on underneath the water, behind the scenes, in order to make a successful rescue of people who are at risk of maybe being killed? Tell us more about that.
Yes, and this is what is interesting, is that in this sense, you have to really understand that each situation is very different. And I will give you maybe the three main lessons that I take out of my time at the crisis center. The first, and it's applied to any person faced with a novel or an unexpected situation, is that the first question we should ask at the outset of a crisis or an emergency is not how shall we respond, but the first question must be, what is the problem? Because we have the tendency to intuitively look for immediate measures to address it.
We must do something. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. This activism brings a sense of false confidence.
Yeah.
And what you risk missing out on the big picture.
Yeah.
And there is a famous quote from French Marshal Ferdinand Foch, who lived at the beginning of the century, the 20th century, and he said in French, "Nous sommes pressés, asseyons-nous." We are in a hurry, let's sit down.
Let's sit down, yeah.
And so before jumping on actions and quick decisions, it's better just to sit down, take a time to breathe, reflect, and analyze the problem. This is the first lesson. The second is that plans are usually useless, but planning is indispensable.
It's true.
And this is not for me. This is a famous quote from General and President Eisenhower.
Yes, I've heard it. It's a military expression I've heard before.
Exactly. And this is the same sense that in this military tradition, the fact that no battle plan will survive the first contact with the enemy, this is an axiom that has been learned and taught in all military academies. And that means for us now in organization is that if we have everything in the binder, the crisis organizations, the protocol, the procedures, it's nice to have them in my binder. But the time and effort you put into the binders should be almost as equivalent or less than all the practice you put around it.
Mm.
Looking at the what if this happened, what if a pandemic? In 2004 and 2006, we had H1N1.
Mm-hmm.
And the question we're asking us is, what's happening for us? So a lot of lessons that we hardly learn again now were learned before.
Thank you.
If I may finish on this, the last lesson is that as leader, we should be prepared to lead from anywhere.
Mm.
premises and statues restrain agility, and they are more a question of prestige than impact. And the location you should have is where you can have the most influence and impact. And now, for the past 7 years, I haven't had any office. It was a big shock at first for my colleagues in the center and for visitors. But I was able, and I've been able to work over the past years from everywhere, from home. I live in the Lavaux, I live from train, from different floor in our building.
That's a good point, a very good point to make.
Because it's easy to tell you start to be agile when you're not yourself.
Yes.
So you have to lead your sense by example.
Absolutely.
And for us, it meant that in March 2020, at the start of the pandemic and the lockdown, over a weekend, on 2 days, we were able to fully transform the center into a virtual setting. So the participants saw no changes. There was no stuff for 1 or 2 weeks to prepare. We went fully virtual in a smooth way. And that was impressive for the participants because it was the Swiss soft power in action. And they really appreciated this.
That's a very
interesting
point.
It was not intended, but it was the feedback we received.
Great, Christian. I've got more questions for you. But my guest today is Ambassador Christian Ducey, the departing director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy, GCSP. And we're talking about what his organization does and, among other things, how Switzerland projects soft power. Christian, I personally would find it interesting to understand better from you how a neutral country like Switzerland uses its soft power. It certainly has a lot of it and is respected and trusted by many all over the world. And GCSP, as you've just pointed out, is a perfect example. But please explain this conundrum to me, Christian. Last year, it seems, according to some Swiss newspapers I read, that the Swiss government got itself into an apparently odd situation with China and granted certain privileges to that country to conduct particular immigration matters on Swiss territory. Now, how does a neutral country walk that very fine line between interest and disinterest? Isn't it rather like being a little bit pregnant, Christian? Surely it's either one thing or the other. Maybe I've got it completely wrong, but please cast some light on this for me.
Yes, Michael, you touch a delicate point here, and there is no interest or disinterest. There are values and interests. And for example, for us, they are clearly defined in the new Swiss foreign policy strategy for the year 2020 to 2023. And this document is important because it's a strategic compass for the Federal Council and federal administration to position our country in the world, while at the same time maintaining the flexibility to respond quickly to changes.
Is that a public document, Christian? I mean,
yes,
can we
yes,
read it
yes,
on the
you can
federal
just,
website?
Absolutely, you yep. can have it in many different national official languages in English. You know that any strategy don't work or doesn't work, but you have to execute it not in a vacuum. You have to execute it in a very complex environment. You pursue your interests, promote your values with specific instruments, but execution is, as with any corporate or military strategy, is the most difficult part. It's a result of choices, sometimes tactical. They represent the balance and sometimes the equilibrium between competing interests.
So what about this particular China example then? What actually happened?
Well, I don't know the detail because I'm not working within the federal administration. But what I see when I was taking with my colleague is where China specifically is concerned. This may mean that Switzerland faces conflicting objectives. Mm-hmm. That's true. Such conflicts are inherent to any policy making or foreign affairs. But also they reflect this pluralist political system. And the close integration and more closer integration between the domestic policies and the foreign policies. And this is why sometimes this equilibrium is difficult to achieve and maybe perceived from the outside as something that is not coherent. And the question of coherence is really one of the main points of the current strategy. Because over the past strategies, we have seen that there are sectoral strategies that are difficult to synchronize. And any strategy is easy to write. But execution and the synchronization,
absolutely,
this is why the key. And it needs the efforts and the understanding. This is why I mentioned before the need to understand your partner, their worldviews, their interests, so that really we can execute the strategy in the best way.
I see. Okay. I'm not sure I understand completely how the China thing works, but I guess it's a complex thing which is being handled in other sections of the government. But before we close, Christian, give me a couple more examples, if you can, and explain, in your opinion, successful uses of Swiss soft power, just so we have something that we can grasp and hold on to, as if we're not familiar with the kind of work that is done by the Swiss Foreign Ministry.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. The concept of soft powers were coined by an American political scientist, Joseph Nye, in the 90s. And it's a country's ability to influence the world, not by military strength, but a lot of other assets, such as culture, art, education, values, cuisine, sport, political system, foreign policies. And these are really the currencies of soft power. And for us in Switzerland, it has played a very crucial role for years, decades, and even centuries. But the thing is also to understand that it's not something that is only linked to foreign policies. It's a whole of government approach. It's a whole of society approaches. And we can see right here in Geneva the impact of this soft power. We hosted talks on Syria, on Iran, on Yemen. Even the Maison de la Paix, our home with many institutions, which is the result of a public-private partnership. It's another asset of soft power. It leveraged what we have here, the unique esprit de Genève, the spirit of dialogue in the capitalist peace.
You're talking now about Switzerland at the UN or Switzerland through the GCSP, or is it a mix of both?
It's a mix of both. It's the fact that Switzerland hosts so many international organizations in Geneva. There are more than 700 NGOs. The fact that we can host a very large diversity of actors, that the ecosystem is spectacular, that locations matters. And Geneva will have a more important location in the future because of the polarization, because of the competition, the rivalry between the US and China, and the question mark on where the European Union is going to position itself. And for Switzerland will also be an important question. And been developing several strategies that the foreign ministry has published on the Middle East, on China, and so on. And there is something new that also is just been created a few months ago, is the Trust Valley. We know that in this information age, credibility is really the scarcest resources. And this Trust Valley in Lausanne on the digital, as a digitalization is taking more importance in our lives. This is really, with all the organization taking part of it, really a new kind of soft power and gift and offer of Switzerland to the world. We receive much as a Swiss, so we have also a responsibility to give.
Yeah, fascinating. Last question, Christian. I would not expect you to comment on your new position before you even get there. But for the benefit of our listeners who might not remember, because we have quite a few relatively younger members, or even know about the events of 41 years ago, I mean the Iranian Revolution, the fall of the Shah, and Switzerland's protecting power mandate for the United States in Iran, which it has performed since 1980. Please give me and our listeners a brief explanation of what it entails. And I'm sure you know the story well.
Thank you for the question, Michael. I'm very much looking forward to this new position, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity that has been given to me. The protecting power mandate, if I may just define what it is, it allows states to maintain a low-level relations and provide consular protection to nationals of the other states. And so the protecting power mandate in Iran dates back, as you mentioned, to the 1980 hostage crisis, when the U.S. broke off relations with Iran following the country's self-proclamation as an Islamic Republic, and that the students occupied the U.S. embassy in Tehran, taking a number of U.S. diplomats hostage. So the Swiss mandate that we have since then was the result, and this is interesting to remember, of the result of several factors. The first one is Swiss neutrality. The second is that the Swiss, we have the experience on this type of mandate for a long time.
Really?
We have a long tradition of good offices in this. The golden period, if I may call it like this, was during the Second World War. And by 1943, 1944, Switzerland was managing more than 200 mandates for 35 states. It was quite a lot. And the Cold War resulted also in a large demand for Swiss services with 24 mandates held, for example, in 1973. And now we have seven. And there are the US in Iran is one of them. But also this is Iran in Egypt, Iran in Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia in Iran, Iran in Canada, Russia in Georgia, and Georgia in Russia. So key region, key issues that have been entrusted to us as a go-between or messenger. The third reason for the decision is that both the US and Iran has experienced Swiss protecting mandates in the past. During the World War II, Switzerland represented the US in Germany, in France, but also Iran in Germany, Italy, and Japan, the Axis powers. And finally, it comes always back to personal relationship. And the network of the Swiss ambassadors in Washington and Tehran at the time in the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s were critical. And here, the personal action and engagement of the Swiss ambassador in Tehran at the time, Eric Lang, in the negotiation for the liberation of the hostages, they played really a key role. And so these are the factors that explain why Switzerland has been representing the US interest.
Thank you very much. I had no idea, in fact, that Switzerland had such a long and involved history. Of course, the Second War I knew a little bit about, but I'm sure many people listening will be very grateful to you for that explanation. Many thanks, Christian, for answering my questions so fully. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you all success, and I know those listening who know you wish you all success with the demands that will certainly be placed upon you in your new position and posting to Tehran. My guest today has been Ambassador Christian Ducey, departing director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy and soon to be Switzerland's newest ambassador to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Thank you again, Christian.
Thank you, Michael, again. It was lovely to be with you.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.